We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
On the program in this hour, we are going to talk about computers and you. This is a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of the program on the first Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest this month. He is with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And I'm sorry to say I won't be able to take email today, but we'll get that up and running, hopefully, by tomorrow in the 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock hours of the program. So, Peter Kimball, it's been a while. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine. It was August when I was here last, and it feels a bit like August now.
It does. But it's a lovely. This weather is lovely.
It is, and hopefully people are out enjoying it and not spending too much time in front of their computer systems, although recent studies have shown that very few people would be willing to give up their computers or phones. It's surprising the ranking that people give a lot of these things.
Okay, so what would they rather give up?
Well, a recent study indicated that one-fifth of people would give up sex before they would give up their computers, and one-third would give up their sex before they gave up their phones. So that's just an interesting little statistical tidbit to
start us off
first week with.
Okay. So, well, that's interesting.
And it's, of course, in large part due to a lot of the innovations of Steve Jobs that now people are carrying their computers in their pockets. The computers, the smartphones, the iPhones, and the Android competitors to and the alternative have more computing power in somebody's pocket than was available in a massive desktop system even 10 years ago.
Yeah. And the Apple products are so elegant. And they are, I would say they are intuitive. When you take them out of the box, there's not much to learn. The learning curve is, you're there.
That's true. That's the way nearly all the products seem to be moving, and Jobs was one who set a lot of that into motion, for sure.
Yeah. Well, he made a mark on personal computing and the culture, and I wonder, if from your point of view, Peter, which of his accomplishments, which of the products of Apple do you think have been the most significant?
Well, if I look at it from the computing point of view, then we're going to go back and look at the Macintosh back in 1984, which opened up a whole new way of interacting with a computer. But I think probably the much larger effect in areas beyond just computing was with the original iPod and the portable music moving on into the other devices, which have just become ubiquitous.
Yeah. Well, now the iPad, it seems, maybe has, and this is a different, you didn't mention the iPad, but the iPad now, it seems like Amazon and Kindle are going to give it a run for its money, although I don't know if you can fairly compare the new Kindles to the iPad. What do you think?
Well, they're not trying to be a new iPad. What they're trying to do is to make it incredibly easy to access media, whether it be books, music, video, etc. That's a major function of the iPad. A lot of people use it for that. And the interesting thing, and why they are given a fairly good chance of making a significant mark in the public's mind and gathering a fair amount of market share, is that the pricing of this new Kindle Fire, as it's called, is less, just under $200, as opposed to the cheapest iPad, which is up around $300 or $400 and goes up from there. And, of course, it's going to be difficult for Barnes & Noble to compete with that, with their Nook. And we've already seen with the proliferation of online services and Amazon's growth the demise of one of the nationwide books chains, Borders. And here locally, much the same kind of factors were behind the demise of a local favorite bookstore here in Champaign-Urbana, the old Pages for All Ages.
Yeah.
So it's a time of shakeout, I think, and the net result, as long as we retain at least a couple of different competitive viable options, is going to be good for the consumer and user, as long as we don't move into a monopolistic sort of a only one provider, and hopefully that won't happen. It doesn't seem to be.
Well, one of the questions that I have is, I know on the iPad you can have a Kindle, you can have stuff from Amazon, you can buy stuff from Amazon on your iPad, but can you put stuff from Apple on a Kindle?
That I have not really tried to experiment with. I believe that there is going to be more of a coalescence of all of those various sources and the devices that you play on it. Eventually, there should certainly be no real difference in what kind of device you're using and where you're getting the information from. That's certainly not true at the moment. The new Amazon offering has exclusive access to some of the things that Amazon has that they are not making available for the Apple, and that you cannot get through the iStore. Part of that is because of licensing arrangements, especially with the media and such that Amazon has, and Apple does the same sort of thing. But hopefully that exclusivity will tend to fade, and we'll be left with a couple of viable alternatives, as I said before.
Yeah.
But there is definitely it's almost a microcosm of much of the competition that has been done. A number of companies are trying to acquire a number of patents so that they can protect their market share by not necessarily their particular product, but by making sure that they have a toehold in products that use a particular technology. So there's this proprietary sense of let's acquire a whole bunch of patents. One reason that Motorola's cell phone division was just purchased, not so much because of their cell phones, but because of the vast patent holdings they have. The same kind of thing in the media area. There are all of these interests in having exclusive, at least for a time, rights to a particular video, to a particular film, etc., and it's all for market advantage, and hopefully much of that will sort itself out and we'll be able to have freedom of choice of both devices and what we want to use them for.
It'd be really interesting to see how this sorts itself out or how it gets sorted out, because so much of the money to be made is in what we buy to put on our devices, and maybe one day we're going to be thinking about how it gets stored and where it gets stored and what that costs.
Well, and that's the other big area. And you mentioned, of course, the applications and the media that we buy or more and more these days rent. You don't have permanent rights to it. You've got a right to use it for some time, or you've got a right to use it only on a particular device. But the other, of course, giant factor in this is the advertising and some of the concerns and some of the issues that will have to be addressed as we go forward will be to ensure that various online resources treat the marketplace fairly. I don't really think that Google, for example, is unfairly manipulating the marketplace, but they are so large and such a dominant factor that that's why Google's CEO is now testifying in front of Congress. Questions raised about do they favor their own product lines or their own affiliates in Google searches. I don't believe that's really the case as a systematic approach. But there are concerns, much like there was a concern, 15 or 20 years ago with Microsoft being accused of manipulating the marketplace by requiring or offering major incentives for companies, computer companies in particular, to offer their particular browser, Internet Explorer, as opposed to the others. So there's going to be a fair amount of shakeout, and the whole area of so-called net neutrality comes into play there as well, which has recently, in some reports, been pretty clearly misunderstood. There are some who have said, no, we want to keep the government out of the Internet, so this net neutrality is not a good idea because it's government regulation about what can be done on the Internet, and actually it's just the opposite. Net neutrality refers to requirements that a particular provider, an internet service provider, be it Comcast, be it AT&T, be it any of the major internet providers, don't somehow prioritize their particular products so that competing products perhaps load much more slowly and therefore are much less attractive. That could, of course, if it were unchecked, move on to going to particular sites or particular providers. And if you visit a site that happens to agree with the political views of one company, those sites load quickly, but others don't load as quickly. It's avoiding that kind of unfair treatment of the information flowing over the internet that this whole net neutrality is about. And all of these are going to be tied together. There's going to be a real need to look at this and try to, with a minimum of intrusion, allow a maximum of flexibility and freedom for the consumer.
Mm. This is Focus. This morning we're talking about computers. Our guest today is Peter Kimball. He is with the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And my apologies, this morning we're not able to take email questions, but we hope to have that up and running tomorrow. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. A little slow this morning, no one waiting for us at the moment. Listeners, if you've got a question, now would be a great time to jump in and give us a call. So what else have you been thinking about technology-wise over the last little while here?
Well, one of my frequent topics is to try to alert people to safe computing practices and to various scams that are going about. They, of course, keep getting more and more sophisticated because there is more and more money to be made from those things. One that just came across my came across my screen, came across my desk. I mean, the phrase used to be came across the desk, was a dealing with used car purchases. And there are now, there is Kelly's Blue Book is one of the premier resources for people determining what their used car is worth or how much is a fair price to pay for a used car given its mileage and condition, etc. And now there are utterly convincing fake Kelly Blue Book sites out there that actually have many of the same links, and their whole purpose is to attempt to get a consumer to click on a link to go to another site, offering things like, if this car isn't what you thought it was, we will offer you a guarantee. And it looks completely legitimate, although Kelly's Blue Book does not offer that kind of a thing. And then you order the car, you know, sight unseen, and with the understanding that it'll be shipped. And it all looks so legitimate. And a number of people have had success going to online sales, Craigslist and others. But now when they go to Craigslist or other online advertisement sources and then they go to Kelly's Blue Book, they may well be redirected, unknowns to them, to a site that makes it seem like this will be a risk-free transaction, except it's all part of a giant scheme.
Let's take a call. This is a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had just a quick question about sort of the market, how it's going to play out with the recent announcement of the iPhone 4S. As you mentioned, Motorola being acquired, or their cell phone division being acquired by Google, and then the passing of Steve Jobs. Does this mean a big shift in sort of the cell phone market, the portable electronics market? Will, do these sort of things, the confluence of these indicate some big change that's going to happen, or I'm just wondering what your opinion is on that. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, if I had a really precise opinion, I would go out and invest my money and probably make a fortune. My feeling and sense of this is there may be some immediate slight turmoil. Apple stock may go up and down a little bit, down perhaps a bit because Steve Jobs is no longer the visionary force behind Apple, and then back up as people realize, wait a minute, the company hasn't really changed that much. I don't really anticipate a major shakeup. There was already some disappointment among Apple aficionados that the recent announcement of the iPhone 4S was not actually an announcement of the iPhone 5. But that's really in accord with Apple's philosophy. They would have felt that the iPhone 5, the higher speed access, the 4G access and all the rest was just not ready yet, did not meet what at the time would have been Steve Jobs' demanding specifications for this has to be as perfect as we can get it, and we will release no device before its time, to paraphrase the Gallows. And the Google acquisition of Motorola's cell phone division was mostly so that Google could protect itself with the vast array of patents that Motorola has, because Google is under some challenge now in terms of the Android operating system. But I don't anticipate there will really be a major shakeup. This is, of course, completely my own opinion, and I'm, as one says, I'm not giving investment advice, but the... it's not a time that I would go out and dump a lot of Apple stock or necessarily buy a lot of things. The market in general is in somewhat turmoil, of course, with Apple stock being up around $300+ per share. I wouldn't probably be buying very much of it anyway.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, it all depends where you are, too. I mean, there's the question of the people who have been committed fans of the iPhone. And maybe they'll wait for 5, but for somebody who's looking for a new phone, their contract's up, they got a phone that's old, you know, maybe this would be for them.
It could be. I know that Apple and previously, of course, Steve Jobs had wanted to increase the iPhone's share. Now, as a single manufacturer of a single device or a series of devices, the iPhone 4S and the 4 and the 3, et cetera, their 5% share of cell phones out in the world is very respectable, but it is still only 5%. Of course, the other 95% are made up of many, many, many different companies. The primary competitor these days is the series of phones made by a number of companies running the Android operating system, as opposed to cell phone from Apple running what's called iOS. And so that's going to be, I think, the way of things for the future. It's much the same way with the Apple Mac and the. Well, let's just stay with the desktop computers and the Apple Macintosh. They are a single source, a single provider. So as a single company, they were doing extremely well, obviously a great value to their users and also to the stockholders. But still, the total Apple penetration, the Macintosh penetration of the marketplace is a fairly small percentage, maybe 10 or 15%, depending on which area you're looking at. That's outstanding for a particular individual manufacturer, but it's not the same sort of thing such as the Microsoft Windows operating system, which is available on computers from, I don't know, scores, if not hundreds of manufacturers. But it is interesting, just to extend that a little bit, the previews of the next Windows operating system, Windows 8, is very much touch-oriented and is going to behave very much like tablets do now from both the Android side of tablets and the iPads. So I think we're going to see a convergence, as we were discussing earlier. It's going to eventually not really matter that much what sort of device you have. You'll be able to do much of the same sorts of things with much of the same ease as before, although I suspect that Apple will always be, if they continue as they have, and there's no reason to expect that they won't, I suspect that Apple will continue to lead the pack a bit in terms of the high-tech glamour feature, very compact, very much aesthetically engineered, and certainly with very solid technology. And part of that solid technology aspect is most likely why they did not at this time choose to release an iPhone 5.
Hmm. Speaking of phones and going back to what you were talking about earlier in terms of security issues, it seems that people are expecting the next big target for problems in that regard will be phones and perhaps tablets. What do you know about that?
Well, that's certainly a legitimate concern, especially because that's becoming, if not the predominant, certainly one of the major computing platforms. A number of people, and I know several myself, when their desktop computer reaches end of life, they aren't really replacing it with another desktop computer. They're replacing it with an iPad or an Android tablet. And as Willie Sutton famously said when asked, why does he rob banks? That's where the money is. And the various malicious software out there, which is no longer malicious just to be mean, it's malicious to make money, is going to start targeting the predominant use of computers, and that's going to move into tablets. Not so much cell phones directly, although smartphones are a target. It's very difficult to hijack or cause damage to a cell phone via cellular communications, but as soon as they start communicating via Wi-Fi, via public hotspots and such, then that opens them up just as it opens a regular computer. So that is going to be an area that no doubt the malicious software writers will continue to target more aggressively in the future. And caution is always in order. We've already talked about this in terms of laptop computers and past visits, but when you go to a, you know, if you're traveling and you go to a coffee shop or you go to some public Wi-Fi area, you need to be careful about what you do. This is not a place to do all of your online banking, for example.
Yeah. What are some other things we should keep in mind as we use Wi-Fi in public hotspots safely?
Well, one of them is, and this is, I haven't seen or heard any reports of this happening in our local area, but certainly have in larger areas. Someone can fairly easily, the technology is there and built into most computer systems, actually, can set up what's called a rogue hotspot. So they could set up their own little Wi-Fi transmitter, basically just with their computer, while they're sitting, for example, in a coffee shop, give it a name such as, let's say Starbuck 2 or something of that sort that would look similar to the name. And if they happen to be sitting close to you, then when you fire up your laptop or your iPad or your Android tablet and look for Wi-Fi networks that you connect to, one of the top ones on the list will be the one that's going to have the higher power, and it may be a rogue hotspot. And if you connect to it, then everything you send is going to be going through that person's computer and through that person's system. And unless you were dealing with it in an encrypted way, which we'll talk about in a second, then everything you do is an open book to them. So the way to avoid that, if there's any question at all, is to ask the clerk, ask whoever is employed there, what is the actual name of your Wi-Fi hotspot, and make sure that you choose that and not some variant on it. I was just traveling down in the Fort Worth area, and I'm not quite sure why they did this, but one of them was it was something like a it was a facility called the Gaylord Texan, and there was a Gaylord Convention Center hotspot, and then there was one that was actually called Fake Gaylord. Now, I don't think anybody would click on Fake Gaylord, but had they named it Gaylord Convention 2, somebody might have. And I have no idea why, you know, what the Fake Gaylord was. I suspect it was actually part of the Gaylord Texan network just to keep people off of it. I have no idea what they were doing, because nobody who was really trying to trick people is going to name it something like that, or, you know, crooksrus.com or those sorts of things.
And also, maybe what we should talk about, this is something that we've talked about in the past, but it's always good to revisit these things every once in a while, because not everybody's tuned in at the same time, for example. But the VPN, the virtual private network,
is a personal, super encrypted tunnel, really. Imagine the public internet as being this vast super highway with all, I know it's an overused cliche, but this vast bit of traffic going every place. And now imagine that what you can do, instead of having to get out there with all those other cars and all that other traffic and all that other information being transferred on the public internet, what you have done is you have arranged to have created a private tunnel that only you have access to. It's heavily encrypted at both ends. once you've established that, we'll talk about how you can do that in a moment, then anything you sent is going to be encrypted from the moment it leaves your computer system. Even if you are, for example, connecting to a secure website, one website that has at the beginning of its address, for example, instead of just the HTTP, which is the standard web communication protocol, it ends with an S. It's HTTPS, which stands for secure. Even if you're connected to that, you're even doubly protected, because before it even talks to that encrypted, you have encrypted your, you've sent everything down this tunnel, this virtual private network. So it's like it's your own wire, but it's not really, and thus the virtual. So how does one do that? Mm-hmm. It requires two things. There has to be some kind of software on your individual computer or device that can do the encryption and connect to the second part that's required, which is a VPN service or VPN software at whoever you're talking to. It's for University of Illinois employees, for example, or those who have university net IDs. There is a VPN service useful if, for example, you're traveling at a conference and you need to connect back to some resource back at the University of Illinois. And by specifying that ID, you have established a private connection and you're relatively secure. In fact, you're almost completely secure from electronic eavesdropping. If you are not connected with a institution that has a VPN, there are a couple of ways of going with that. There are a number of private VPN providers that's, in some cases, I've seen some prices as low as $5 a month. Basically, what you do is you get an address and you get this appropriate software, and when you're ready to establish a session, you just fire up that software, it connects to that VPN service, so you've got a private tunnel to there, and from there, then it sends it out to wherever the destination is going to be. That means you don't have to worry about people eavesdropping in the hotspot, or you don't have to worry about people tapping into it in your hotel or any place else.
Okay. Let's take a call. This is another listener in Urbana. Line one, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, one of the new developments is the USB 3, and it doesn't look as though it's being too widely adopted. I recently bought an external drive, hard drive, a SATA, that is equipped for either USB 3 or 2, or I guess 1 for that matter. But I have an older computer that I don't think has, PSL Express slot available. And my understanding is you do need an Express slot.
That may be the case. Certainly there are USB 3 plug-in cards available, but because the speed is so much faster, it can't plug into the slower bus or the slower connections that a lot of expansion cards would plug into on older computer systems. The USB 3, obviously it's the third standard. It's about 10 times faster than the old USB 2 if you have things that can take advantage of it. Now, that means that things like your, connecting your digital camera to it, USB 2 is going to be fast enough to download almost anything from your digital camera. But for things like hard drives where you want the fastest throughput, certainly USB or the SATA, the SATA technology, you may not be able to find. You could do a search for USB cards, and with whatever sort of else you've got. And I don't know that you would need a PCI bus, but I haven't really looked into it. Most newer computers, at least other than those at the very bottom end of the price level, are now having they are coming with USB 3 ports, because it's very little additional expense for the manufacturer to include the USB chipset, the information. The technology as compared to USB 2.
I was wondering, I also have a notebook, and at present it has a USB 2 card. That is, it's through the card slot. What I've read looks as though that could take a USB 3 card and that it would accept that.
That's go ahead.
Using that as a connection to the external hard drive and using my wired rather than the Wi-Fi, that would probably give as fast connection through the laptop to the my desktop computer.
Well, there are a couple of issues that that might affect that. Yes, it's quite possible that a USB 3 card could plug into the into the PC card slot. Certainly, those PC card slots are already designed to handle small plug-in hard drives, so one would assume that they are therefore connected to the high-speed bus in the laptop, although, again, you'd need to check online about that.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's connected, then assuming that your laptop and your desktop machines are connected via at least 100 megabit per second. You wouldn't want to use just if the connection is only running at 10 megabits per second, standard Ethernet category, so-called Cat 3 connection, you would lose your speed advantage at that point. But if it can run at 100 megabits per second, then you would be probably correct. It would not be quite as fast because there's clearly going to be some overhead in passing it through the operating system of the laptop, which will have to handle the request. At least the underlying BIOS will have to handle the request. So it's passing through a couple of different devices, but it should be nearly as fast, assuming that you have at least a fast Ethernet connection hardwired between the two machines, 100 megabit, you know, so-called Category 5 or something, which more recent machines certainly do, and that the PC card slot on your laptop does indeed allow the USB card to communicate at full speed. The USB 3 card would certainly work in there. The question is, would it be limited in speed because of the constraints imposed by the what it's plugging into in the laptop? It will work, but will it work at full speed? And that you'd pretty much need to do some more specialized looking at some of the forms for your particular laptop.
Yeah. The if it does work, going through a Cat 5, it would be faster than a USB connection to the other computer. But it probably wouldn't be as fast as being directly connected to the other computer through a USB.
I think that is correct, yes.
I'm
looking for the... So we're looking at a speed of about... Oh, I'm just trying to see what the specification is here. It's about 5 gigabits per second is the maximum transmission speed for USB, which is for USB 3.
Mm-hmm.
Which, now that's gigabits per second, which is, you'd have to divide that by about 8 to get how many bytes per second. So it's a bit under 100 megabytes per second, which is certainly incredibly fast and is going to exceed, well, it's going to be a toss-up depending upon the speed of your Ethernet connection, but 100 megabit per second Ethernet 5 connection is not going to be able to keep up with that. So now we're looking at Cat 6 and the 1,000 megabit per second connection, which is going to, as I look at these numbers, going to be the only thing that would theoretically allow USB 3 type speeds to pass through.
Mm-hmm.
And not all that many computers, some of the more recent ones certainly do, and some of no doubt have this connected through a router or a wireless access point, even though you're going wired. Not all of those will handle. You'd have to check and make sure it's recent enough to be able to handle 1,000 megabits per second, typically identified as 10/100/100/1,000, because just staying at 100, you're going to obviate the advantage of USB 3.
Yeah. My understanding is you have to be a bit careful. USB 2 cables will work, but they limit the speed to USB 2. So you need a USB 3 cable to connect to the computer with a USB 3 device. The other thing, apparently not too many desktop computers are actually coming with USB 3 now. I think HP is, but a lot of the others aren't. And I understand Apple has an alternative system they're going to. Do you know anything about their new system?
It's their expansion of or their add-on, I believe, to the FireWire system. So they have gone through FireWire 400 and FireWire 800, those referring to the megabits per second speed.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not yet experimented or really explored that, but yes, an Apple system is actually, as the FireWire was, it is a standard. It is just Apple's branding of that standard for FireWire. And those same sorts of adapters, IEEE, well, I can't remember the number, but it's a particular code for the specification. Those sorts of cards, FireWire, if it's Apple, but IEEE 466 or 486 or something, I just the number is escaping me at the moment,
mm-hmm.
Can also be acquired as plug-in cards for non-Apple machines.
Yes, they're a little bit slower than the USB 3, as I understand it.
That's my understanding as well. But wait 3 or 4 years for USB 4.
Yes, well, I may very well do that because I really am not compelled to get a new computer until they discontinue supporting XP.
Well, you've got about a year and a half.
Yeah, and at that time, it's probably cheaper to buy a new computer and get the whatever it is, Windows 8 or whatever, than it is to buy Windows 8 when it comes out.
Almost certainly, and certainly much less trouble. The days of really being able to easily and conveniently just upgrade an existing system for much less than a new one have largely passed, mostly because you won't be able to take advantage of a lot of the newer technologies unless you replace almost everything in the old computer system.
It looks to me it would mean replacing the motherboard, and if you say almost everything, to upgrade a computer to USB 3.
Yes,
and
motherboard.
Mine has survived for 10 years, and it's operating just great, but I think another year and a half, and its day may be relegated to backup computer.
Well, that's probably a good use for it because it can certainly handle a lot of that. And if you were to set it up, and I will need to leave this in here in just a moment, but you could actually set it up with appropriate software if you look at it as a VPN server of your very own. But that's a topic for another time.
Okay. And I want to thank the listener for his call. We've got a couple of other callers waiting for us. From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn, our guest this morning, Peter Kimball. The topic, computers, will continue the discussion after a quick break.
On the next Fresh Air, a new strategy called Red Map to engineer a Republican takeover of state legislatures where redistricting is pending, and the multimillionaire who poured money into helping that strategy succeed in North Carolina, a key battleground state. We talk with Jane Mayer about her article, State for Sale, in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Jason Croft, our guest this morning, Peter Kimball. We're talking about computers. Let's go back to the phones and take another call. This is a listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Yeah, is that for me?
Yes.
Okay, I have an article in front of me. It's pedestrian. It's not as technical as what's called. Make sure the problem is not in your chair. It's a long article talking about the laptop on your lap, that it's not a good idea. It damages computers. Letting a laptop rest on your thighs or worse, and they go on. And speaking, I'm jumping around, but I'd like your response to some of these assertions. Speaking of the hard drive, don't walk around with your laptop while the hard drive is active because its actuator arm, which skitters over the surface reading or saving data, could bump into, if they'd explain it. A lot of people close the lid on their laptop and throw it in the case without making sure the hard drive has shut down completely, and she goes into that. This is written by Kate Murphy in last Thursday's New York Times. And it's a good idea to listen. Am I going too fast?
No.
No, that's fine.
Is it a good idea to listen for the hard drive? I don't even know what a hard drive is. To stop spinning before moving a laptop. And he says, depending on the brand of the computers, the lights could be green, amber, or red. In Apple computers, it's a white light pulsating in a rhythm. And she goes on. Another common error is leaving the laptop plugged in all the time. Now, that was really news to me. Unplugging your laptop once in a while, staying 2 to 3 times per week, is enough to keep the battery fit. She goes on. I'm just going over it quickly and out of context.
Well, you've given Peter a number of...
Let me just finish it fast. Dust can cause problems, and it should be like cleaning your ears, and she goes... Finally, most experts advise shutting down computers every few days to clear out the cache and short-term memory, and she describes it more. Do you get the idea?
Well, a lot of those things are certainly excellent suggestions, and I'll address 2 or 3 of them in just a couple of moments here. As far as keeping it on your lap, yes, that is going to basically block some of the ventilation that is designed into laptops. There's a lot of circuitry in there generating a fair amount of heat, and it does need to be ventilated. They generally have a little fan, although you don't hear it nearly as much as on a desktop. And if you block the vents, which would be such as putting it on your lap or on a soft cushion or something, you can indeed cause the circuitry to overheat. And we did have one computer actually fail, although it took a while, just because of heat damage. So that is an excellent suggestion. As related would be to make sure that you have put it in sleep mode or hibernation mode rather than just closing it and throwing it into a case, because it doesn't always shut off. It may stay active, and of course in the case it's not going to be able to get much ventilation. The battery, it's not really that much of an issue. You don't really want to drain the battery entirely, but with the lithium-ion batteries, there's not nearly as much of a concern, so I wouldn't worry too much about that, as opposed to the old nickel-cadmium or NiCad batteries, which had a real issue in terms of battery life. Be aware that the lithium batteries in laptops may well, even if you treat them as delicately as possible, do have a limited lifetime, and the time will come, and it may not be for 3 or 4 or 5 years, that you may have to replace that battery anyway. But and then the final thing that I guess I can address, and people could certainly look this article up.
That's what I wanted to give yes. you the details.
And the final thing is the in terms of the hard drive, yes, it's not really a great idea to move it around while the light is flashing. You're not going to typically hear the hard drive or at least be able to identify it on a laptop. They're pretty quiet. But almost every laptop, and you can look at the documentation for the particular manufacturer, has some sort of light that flashes as the hard drive is being accessed. The catch is you can't necessarily stop doing things and expect it to stop accessing the hard drive, because there's a lot of stuff going on in the background, updating various files, making backups, all sorts of things going on. So even if you just leave it sitting there, it may periodically be active, and that's another reason that if you're going to be moving it, of course, make sure that you put it in sleep or hibernation mode. But you probably want to avoid... I've carried mine around a little bit, not much, but when I've had to, and I just make sure I keep it level and don't, you know, jar it, don't bump into anything. Hard drives for laptops are designed to be pretty robust, although they can, of course, fail. Newer laptops actually, and it's more expensive, have solid-state hard drives. That's a misnomer, really, but it doesn't have any moving parts, and they are much more robust, but that's a bit more expensive as well.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how to access this article. So if people want to read all those details, I appreciate your response. Not that I understand much of it, but I'll ask my son. Make sure the article is by Kate Murphy, Murphy. It appeared in September 29, 2011 issue in the business section, and the title is Make Sure the Problem is Not in Your Chair. It's a personal tech article.
And you can find it, actually, it's featured on the digital page, the digital, the technology page of the New York Times online. It's still featured there.
That's right, personal tech.
Yep.
On page B as in boy, 6. And I think it's worth studying it. I mean,
yep.
It sounds to me as if there are things that people can use.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, so that was a pedestrian question.
No, I think it was a very helpful question and a helpful piece of advice as well to go and look at that article.
Okay, thank you for being so knowledgeable.
Let's take another call. This will be, I think, our last call today. Line 3, Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I was calling because I was trying to follow the discussion about public privacy.
Yes.
Doing stuff in public. What about the Verizon wireless that you actually can carry your own with you?
Well, if you're referring to using your cell phone and connecting it.
No, no.
Oh, okay.
On the PC.
Oh, on the PC.
On the laptop with Verizon has a device that you can have your own access wherever you go if there's a Verizon tower.
Okay, that would be a device that uses between that device and the device Verizon gives you. It establishes a cell phone connection, except it's not really to a phone. But it connects. It establishes a cellular connection between your device and the nearest Verizon tower. Then that device is using that cellular connection to access the Internet. And at your end, it's acting just like a wireless access point, just like a Wi-Fi point, so mm-hmm. that it's Wi-Fi in your house, but rather than connecting to the cable company or to AT&T or something through a phone line, it's connecting to the Internet via the cellular connection. The cellular part of the connection is quite secure. With the Wi-Fi aspect, like any other kind of Wi-Fi that you set up, you would have to make sure that, and I believe this is the default for Verizon, that it is secure, that you don't have it open so anybody who happens to drive by can also say, oh, look, here is a access to the Internet through
right.
a unsecured Wi-Fi. But
I did that when I first got the computer.
And that would be, you'd need to set that up for any wireless access point that you get, whether it's one that connects to through a cable modem or whether it's one that connects through a DSL line. And the same thing would be true because it is still a Wi-Fi device if it connects through Verizon's cellular network. But I suspect that that's going to be the default case. You certainly would get that information from Verizon when you get such a device. It will no doubt warn you about make sure that you've secured it at your end. It's already secured at the Verizon end.
Okay. I appreciate everything you've been saying, but a lot of it went over my head, and I won't take up time trying to get up to date, but thank you for at least answering that. And
well,
I'll look forward to the next time you're on.
All right. The short answer is don't worry about the Verizon connection. It's secure. And if you get such a device and you find it useful, the instructions will come with it about how to make sure it's secure at your end.
And the other thing I would say is we're all learning, you know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is Peter's line of work. For the rest of us mere mortals, it's a lot tougher, so don't apologize. So anyway, this is Focus, and we're talking this morning about computers. We've got maybe about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. So maybe here I'll just turn it over to Peter and say any last word this morning.
Well, the last word would be make as much use of all of the various computing resources and the access and the social networks, if you're into that, as possible. Don't worry too much about security once you have taken the basic steps, keeping your antivirus and such up to date. The last caller, for example, was concerned about the security. That will, if you follow the guidelines, be pretty much taken care of itself, and those guidelines will come with any such device. And the final thing I will say, because this has become more of a problem, if you are surfing the web and you see all of a sudden a pop-up message that says, warning, we've just discovered 284 viruses on your machine, that is not actually what is happening. That is a malicious pop-up message, and you just close down your browser and pay no attention to it. What it will prompt you to do is to download something that will cause your problems to get worse.
They're looking for you to panic.
That's right. They're trying to go into panic mode.
Okay. There we will leave it for this month. Computers in You, a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball has been our guest this month. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks, Peter.
You're quite welcome. That's going to be the default case. You certainly would get that information from Verizon when you get such a device. It will no doubt warn you about make sure that you've secured it at your end. It's already secured at the Verizon end.
Okay. I appreciate everything you've been saying, but a lot of it went over my head, and I won't take up time trying to get up to date, but thank you for at least answering that.
Well,
and I'll look forward to the next time you're on.
All right. The short answer is don't worry about the Verizon connection. It's secure. And if you get such a device and you find it useful, the instructions will come with it about how to make sure it's secure at your end.
And the other thing I would say is we're all learning, you know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is Peter's line of work. For the rest of us mere mortals, it's a lot tougher. So don't apologize. So anyway, this is Focus, and we're talking this morning about computers. We've got maybe about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. So maybe here I'll just turn it over to Peter and say any last word this morning.
Well, the last word would be make as much use of all of the various computing resources and the access and the social networks, if you're into that, as possible. Don't worry too much about security once you have taken the basic steps, keeping your antivirus and such up to date. The last caller, for example, was concerned about the security. That will, if you follow the guidelines, be pretty much taken care of itself, and those guidelines will come with any such device. And the final thing I will say, because this has become more of a problem, if you are surfing the web and you see all of a sudden a pop-up message that says, warning, we've just discovered 284 viruses on your machine, that is not actually what is happening. That is a malicious pop-up message, and you just close down your browser and pay no attention to it. What it will prompt you to do is to download something that will cause your problems to get worse.
They're looking for you to panic.
That's right. They're trying to go into panic mode.
Okay. There we will leave it for this month. Computers in You, a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball has been our guest this month. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks, Peter.
You're quite welcome.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Well, it's time for a market update. Let's begin in Kansas City with the December wheat contract. It currently stands at $7 even. That's up one quarter. March, $7.16, up three quarters. December wheat in Chicago, $6.19, down six and a quarter. March, $6.55, down five. December corn, $6.08, up two and a half. March, $6.20 and three quarters, up two and a half. May, $6.27 and three quarters, up one and three quarters. July, $6.33, up two and a quarter. November soybeans, $11.67 and a half. That's up three and three quarters. January, $11.79, up three and a half. March, $11.89, up three and three quarters. May, $11.97, up three and a quarter. October meal, $3.02.90, up $1.40. October soybean oil, $49.03. That's up three. October live cattle, 122.17 and a half, down 62 and a half. December, 122 even, down 65. Nothing to report here for feeder cattle. Let's go on to October lean hogs. 94.45, that contract is up 77 and a half. November crude oil, 81.14, up 146. The U.S. dollar, 78.83, down 9. The CRB index, 301.74, up 297. The Dow is up 89 points at 11,029. The S&P 500, 11 higher at 1155. And the NASDAQ is up 29 at 2490. It's noon Central Time, 80 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky is sunny. The forecast this afternoon in East Central Illinois, sunny with a high of 85, the wind from the southeast at 5.